lying space for space, and the top sheet bore the unbelievable words, Crotchet Castle by Thomas Love Peacock. And beneath the title, in a clerkly Indian hand, but again in English, were precise directions for using the book in the encoding of messages. Reviewing my career in India, I'd say that of all the wonders I saw there, that was the greatest. I dare say one should be prepared for anything in a land where an illiterate peasant girl can give you the square root of a six-figure number at first glance. But when I reflect on the skill and speed of those copyists, and the analytical genius that penetrated that code, well, it can still rob me of breath. Not as entirely as it did at the time, though.
Your bunker-boiler confessed how you wrote your ciphers with the aid of a book, sneers the Akali. It was copied in your absence and compared with the intercepted ciphers by these men who are skilled in cryptography. An Indian invention, as Major Broadfoot should have borne in mind.
Oh, ah, indeed, a very simple cipher,
chirps the Chi-Chi, while the baboos beamed and nodded.
Quite elementary, you know, page numbers, dates of Christian calendar, initial letters of alternate lines.
That will do, says Macha Khan, and dismissed them, but one of the baboos couldn't resist a backward gleek at me.
Dr. Folliot and Mr. McQuaidy are jolly good fun,
squeaks he, and waddled out as fast as he could go. I sat sick and trembling. No wonder they'd been able to fake a message to trap me, with one tiny error of style, which I'd been fool enough to ignore. What the devil had I written in my ciphers, though? They'd spotted the allusion to Jen Dan, but I hadn't named her. But what else had I said? You see, says Macha Khan, what you have written of late, we know. What else have you learned up at the fort yonder?
Nothing, as God's my witness, I bleated. General, upon my honor, sir, I protest. Your cryptographers are mistaken or lying. Yes, that's it, I hollered. It's a beastly plot to discredit me, to give you an excuse for war. Well, it won't serve, you scoundrels. What? Yes, it will. I mean, you'll learn fast enough.
Let's have him below, snarls the Akali. He'll babble as freely as his creature did.
There were growls of agreement from the others, and I fairly neighed in alarm.
What do you mean, damn you? I'm a British officer, and if you lay a finger...
They clapped the gag over my mouth again, and I could only listen in horror while the Akali swore that time was pressing. So the sooner they set about me, the better, and they argued to and fro until Macha Khan turned them all out of the room. Except for my three guards and the pock-marked Naik, his face gave me the shudders, but I took some comfort from the fact that Mark had taken matters on himself. Damned uncivil he'd been, what with spy and murderer, but he was a gentleman and a soldier, after all. And like calls to like, you know. Why, standing there, tall and erect, glaring at me and twisting his grizzled moustache, he might have been any staff colonel at Horse Guards, bar the turban. Better still, he addressed me in English, so that the others should be none the wiser.
You spoke of war, says he. It has begun. Our advance guard is already across the Sutlej. In a few days there will be a general engagement between the Khalsa and the company army under Sir Yukov. I tell you this so that you may understand your position. You are now beyond help from Simla.
So, it had finally come, and I was a prisoner of war. Well, better here than there. At least I'd be out of harm's way.
No, you are not a prisoner, snaps Macha Khan. You are a spy. Be quiet.
He took a turn about and leaned down to stare grimly into my face.
We of the Khalsa know that our queen regent has turned traitor. We also suspect the loyalty of Lal Singh, our wazir, and Tej Singh, our field commander. You have been Mai Jandan's intimate, her lover. We know she has sent assurances through you to Broadfoot. So much is plain from your recent ciphers. But what has she betrayed in detail of our plan of campaign? Numbers, dispositions, lines of march, objectives, equipment?
He paused, his black eyes boring into mine.
Your one hope, Flashman, lies in full disclosure. Immediately.
But I don't know anything. I tell you nothing. I've not heard a word of plans or objectives or any such thing. And I haven't even seen my Jindan for weeks.
Our woman Mangala visited you last night.
His words came out like rapid fire.
You spent hours together. What did she tell you? How have you passed it to Simla? Through her, or the man Harlan, who poses as your orderly, or by some other means? We know you sent no cipher today.
As God's my judge, it ain't true. She told me nothing.
Then why did she visit you?
Because we've grown friendly, don't you know? I mean, we talk, you see, and not a word of politics, I swear. We just converse, and so forth.
God, it sounded lame, as the truth often does, and it drove him into a rage.
Either you're a fool, or you think I am, he rasped. Very well, I'll waste no more time. Your Pankawala spoke under persuasion, in unspeakable pain, which I trust you will spare yourself. You have a choice. Speak to me now, in this room, or to this fellow.
He indicated the pock-marked Naik, who took a pace forward, scowling.
In the cellar below.
For a moment I didn't believe my ears. Oh, I'd been threatened with torture before by savages like Ghul Shah and those beastly Malagasies, but this was a man of honor, a general, an aristocrat. I wouldn't believe it, not from someone who might have been Cardigan's own brother, dammit.
You don't mean it!
I yelped.
I don't believe you. It's a trick. A mean, cowardly trick. You wouldn't dare. But you're trying to frighten me, damn you.
Yes, I am.
His voice and eyes were dead level.
But it is no empty threat. There is too much at stake. We are beyond diplomatic niceties or the laws of war. Very soon now, hundreds, perhaps thousands of men will be dying in agony beyond the Sutlej, Indian and British alike. I cannot afford to spare you when the fate of the war may depend on what you can tell me.
By God, he did mean it. And before that iron stare, I broke down utterly, weeping and begging him to believe me.
But I don't know a damn thing. For Christ's sake, it's the truth. Yes, yes, she's betraying you. She promised to warn us. And yes, she's delayed and made the astrologers bungle it.
You tell me what I know already,
cries he impatiently.
But it's all I know, blast you. She never said a word of plans. Oh, if she had, I'd tell you. Please, sir, for pity's sake, don't let them torture me. I can't bear it, and it'd do no good, damn you, you cruel old bastard, because I've nothing to confess. Oh, God, if I had, I'd tell you if I could.
I doubt it. Indeed, I am sure you would not,
says he. And before those words and tone, suddenly so flat, almost weary, I left off blubbering to stir. He was standing ramrod straight, but not in disgust or contempt at my ravings. If anything, he looked regretful, with a touch of ruptured nobility even. I couldn't fathom it until, to my horrified amazement, he went on in the same quiet voice.
You overplay the coward's part too far, Mr. Flashman. You would have me believe you an abject, broken thing, dead to honor, a cur who would confess everything, betray everything at a mere threat, and on whom, therefore, torture would be wasted.
He shook his head.
Major Broadfoot does not employ such people, and your own reputation belies you. No, you will tell nothing, until pain robs you of your reason. You know your duty as I know mine. It drives us both to shameful extremes, me to barbarism for my country's sake, you to this pretense of cowardice, a legitimate ruse in a political agent, but not convincing from the man who held Piper's Fort. I am sorry.
His mouth worked for a moment. I won't swear there wasn't a tear in his blasted eye.
I can give you an hour before they begin. For God's sake, use it to see reason. Take him down.
He turned away like a strong, suffering man who's had the last word. He hadn't, though.
Pretense?
I screamed as they hauled me from the chair.
You bloody old half-wit, it's true. I'm not shamming, damn you, I swear it. I can't tell you anything. Oh, Jesus, please, please let me be. Mercy, you foul old kite. Can't you see I'm telling the truth?
By that time, they were dragging me through the garden to the back of the house, thrusting me through a low, iron-shod door and down an immensely long flight of stone steps into the depths of a great cellar. A dank tomb of rough stone walls with only a small window high up on the far side. A choking, acrid smell rose to meet us, and as the Naik set a burning torch in a bracket by the stair foot, the source of that stench became horribly apparent.
Are you weary, Dagabasi Sahib?
Dagabasi means treachery.
Crazy. See, we have a fine bed for you to rest on.
I looked and almost swooned. In the center of the earth floor lay a great rectangular tray, in which charcoal glowed faintly under a coating of ash. And about 3 feet above it was a rusty iron grill like a bedstead, with manacles at head and foot. Watching my face, the Naik cackled with laughter, and taking up a long poker, went forward and tapped open two little vents on either side of the tray. The charcoal near the vents glowed a little brighter.
"Gently blows the air,"
gloats he,
"and slowly grows the heat."
He laid a hand on the grill.
A little warm only, but in an hour it will be warmer. Dagabasi Sahib will begin to feel it then. He may even find his tongue.
He tossed the poker aside.
Put him to bed.
I can't describe the horror of it. I couldn't even scream as they ran me forward and flung me down on that diabolic gridiron, snapping the fetters on my wrists and ankles so that I was held supine, unable to do more than writhe on the rusty bars. And then the pockmarked fiend picked up a pair of bellows from the floor, grinning with savage delight.
You will be in some discomfort when we return, Dagabasi Sahib. Then we shall open the vents a little more. Your punkawala cooked slowly for many hours, did he not, John? Oh, he spoke long before he began to roast. That followed, though I think he had no more to tell.
He leaned down to laugh in my face.
And if you find it tedious, we may hasten matters thus.
He thrust the bellows under the foot of the grill, pumping once. A sudden gust of heat struck my calves, and I found my tongue at last in a shriek that tore my throat again and again as I struggled helplessly. They crowed with laughter, those devils, as I raved in terror and imagined agony, swearing I had nothing to tell, pleading for mercy, promising them anything, a fortune, if they'd let me go, rupees and mohurs by the luck, God knows what else. Then perhaps I swooned in earnest, for all I remember is the Naik's jeering voice from far off.
In an hour's time, rest well, Dagabasi Sahib.
And the clang of the iron door. There are, in case you didn't know it, 5 degrees of torture, as laid down by the Spanish Inquisition, and I was now suffering the 4th, the last before the bodily torment begins. How I kept my sanity is a mystery. I'm not sure but that I did go mad for a spell, for I came out of my swoon babbling.
No, no, Dawson, I swear I didn't peach. 'Twasn't me, it was Speedycut. He blabbed on you to her father, not me. I swear it. Oh, please, please, Dawson, don't roast me.
And I could see the fat brute's great whiskered moon face leering into mine as he held me before the schoolroom fire, vowing to bake me till I blistered. I know now that that roasting at Rugby was worse, for real corporal anguish, than my ordeal at Lahore. But at least I'd known that Dawson must leave off at the last, whereas in Bibi Khalil's cellar, with the growing heat only beginning to make my back and legs tingle and run rivers of sweat, I knew that it would continue hotter and even hotter, to the unspeakable end. That's the horror of the fourth degree, as the Inquisitors knew. But while their heretics and religious idiots could always get off by telling the bloody dogos what they wanted to hear, I couldn't. I didn't know. The mind's a strange mechanism. Chained to that abominable grill, I began to burn and strain to arch my body away from the bars, until I fainted again. And when I came to my senses, why, I was only uncomfortably warm for a moment, until I remembered where I was, and in an instant my clothes were catching fire, the flames were scorching my flesh, and I shrieked my way into oblivion once more. Yet it was only in my mind, my clothing was barely being singed, whereas Dawson burned my breeches' arse out to the fat swine, and I couldn't sit for a week. I can't tell how long it was before I realized that, while undoubtedly getting hotter and being half suffocated by fumes, I had not yet burst into flames. The discovery steadied me enough to leave off my incoherent squealing and weeping, and rave to some purpose, bellowing my name, rank, and diplomatic status at the very top of my voice, in the faint hope that it might carry through that high window to the distant alleys around the house and attract the attention of a friendly passer-by. You know, some reckless adventurer or knight-errant who'd think nothing of invading a house full of Khalsa thugs to rescue a perfect stranger who was browning nicely in the cellar. I laugh, but it saved me, and taught me the folly of stoic silence. If I'd been Dick Champion, biting the bullet and disdaining to cry out, I'd have been broiled to cinders. Roaring me coward head off did the trick. But only just in time, for my hollering was starting to fade to a hoarse whimper, and the growing heat beating up from below was forcing me to toss and turn continuously when I heard the noise. I couldn't place it at first. A distant scraping, too heavy for a rat, coming from overhead. I forced myself to lie still, laboring for breath. There it was again. Then it stopped, to be followed by a different sound, and for a dreadful moment I knew I had gone mad in that hellish dungeon. It wasn't possible. It could only be a tortured delusion. But in the darkness above me, someone, very softly, was whistling, "Drink, puppy, drink." Suddenly I knew it was real. I was in my senses, writhing on that grill, gasping for air. But there it was again, faint but clear from outside the window, the little hunting song that I whistled all my life. Harry's Pibroch, Elspeth calls it. Someone was using it to signal. I tried to moisten my parched lips with a tongue like leather, found I couldn't, and in desperation began to croak. "For he'll grow into a hound, so we'll pass the bottle round, and merrily we'll whoop and holler." Silence, except for my gasps and groans, then a scrambling rush, a thud, and through the suffocated mist a figure was looming over me, and a horrified face was peering into mine. "Holy Jesus!" cries Jasser. And as the bolt rasped back in the door, he fairly flung himself away, burrowing among the rubble in the shadows along the wall. The door swung open, and the Naik appeared on the threshold. For a long, awful moment he stood looking down at me as I struggled and panted on the grill. In a frenzy of fear that he'd seen Jasser, that the fatal hour was up, and then he sang out,
"Is the bed to your liking, Dagabazi Sahib? What, not warm enough yet? Oh, patience! Only a moment now."
He guffawed at his own priceless wit and went out, leaving the door ajar. And here was Jasser muttering hideous oaths as he worked at my fetters. They were simple bolts, and in a moment he had them loose, and I'd lurched off that hellish gridiron and was lying face down on the filthy, cool earth, panting and retching. Jasser knelt beside me, urging haste, and I forced myself up. My back and legs were smarting, but didn't feel as though they were badly burned, and with the Naik plainly about to return at any moment, I was in a fever to be away. "Can you climb?" whispers Jasser, and I saw there was a camel rope dangling from the window 15 feet above our heads.
"I'll go first. If you can't make it, we'll haul you."
He seized the rope and walked up the wall like an acrobat until he had his legs over the sill.
"Up, quick!" he hissed.
And I leaned on the wall a second to fetch my breath and my senses, rubbed my hands on the dirt and laid hold on the rope. I may not be brave, but I'm strong, and exhausted as I was, I climbed by my arms alone, hauling my dead weight hand over hand, bumping and scraping against the wall. No work for a weakling, but my mortal funk was such that I could have done it with Henry VIII on my back. Up I went, nearly sick with hope, and the sill wasn't a yard above me when I heard the door thrown back in the cell below. I almost let go my hold in despair, but even as a yell sounded from the doorway, Jasser's hand was on my collar, and I heaved for my life. I got an elbow on the sill, looked down, and saw the Naik bounding down the steps with his gang at his heels. Jasser was through the window, hauling at me, and I got a leg over the sill. From the tail of my eye, I saw one of the ruffians below swinging back his hand. There was a flash of steel, and I winced away as a thrown knife struck sparks from the wall. Jasser's pistol banged deafeningly before my face, and I saw the Naik stagger and fall. I yelled with joy, and then I was over the sill. "Drop!" shouts Jasser, and I fell about 10 feet, landing with a jar that sent a stabbing pain through my left ankle. I took one step and went down, bleating, as Jasser dropped beside me and heaved me up again. My heart went out to Gulab Singh and his gouty foot in that moment as I thought, "Crocked, be God, and only one leg to run with." Jasser had me by the shoulders. He let out a piercing whistle, and suddenly there was a man on my other side, stooping beneath my arm. Between them, they half-carried me, howling at every step. Two shots sounded somewhere to my left. I saw pistol flashes in the gloom. People were yelling. Branches whipped my face as we blundered along. And then we were in an alley. A mounted man was alongside, and Jasser was heaving me almost bodily up behind. I clasped the rider around the waist, turning to look back, and there was Bibi Khalil's gate, and a cowled black figure was cutting with a saber at someone within and then sprinting after us. The alley seemed to be full of horsemen. In fact, there were only four, including Jasser. Voices were yelling behind us, feet were pounding, a torch was flaring in the gateway. And then we were round the corner. "Gently does the trick," says Jasser at my elbow. "They ain't horsed. You doing well there, Lieutenant?" "Right, Jemadar, walk, march, trot." He urged his beast ahead, and we swung in behind him. However he came there, he was a complete hand, our Philadelphia sawbones. Left to myself, I'd have been off full tilt, blundering heaven knows where and coming to grief like as not. Jasser knew just where he wanted to go and what time he had in hand. We trotted round a corner into a little court, which I recognized as the one in which Gulab and I had opened the batting. And lo, there were two more riders on post, and to my astonishment I recognized them and my rescuers as black robes of Alec Gardner's. Well, no doubt all would be made clear presently. They led the way up a long lane. At the end, Jasser reined in to look back. By George, there were torches entering the lane at a run, a bare 50 paces behind, and suddenly all my pain and fear and bewilderment vanished in overwhelming blind rage, as often happens when I've been terrified to death and reckon I'm safe. By God, I'd make 'em pay, the vile, torturing scoundrels! There was a pistol in my rider's saddle holster, and I plucked it out, bellowing, while Jasser demanded to know what the devil I was about. "I'm going to kill one of those murdering bastards!" I roared. "Lay hands on me, you poxy vermin! You broil me on a damn gridiron, will you? Take that, you sons of bitches!" I blazed away, and had the satisfaction of seeing the torches scatter, though none of them went down. "Say, won't that line 'em, though?" cries Jasser. "You feel better now, Lieutenant? You sure? Don't want to go back and burn their barn down?" "Fine. Acha, Jemada, Jildi Jow." Which we did, at a steady canter in the broader ways, and at a walk in the twisting alleys, and as we rode I learned from Jasser what had brought my saviors at the 11th hour. He, it seemed, had been keeping a closer eye on me for weeks than ever I knew. He had spotted me leaving the fort and trailed me, wandering to the French soldiers' canteen and Bibi Khalil's house. Skulking in the shadows, he'd seen me received by the widow, and having a foul mind, supposed I was bedded for the night. Fortunately, he'd skulked farther, spied the Khalsar bigwigs downstairs, and realized that there was villainy afoot. Deciding that he could do nothing alone, he'd legged it for the fort and made straight for Gardner. I figured you were treed and needed help in numbers. Alec was the only hope. He may not cotton to me exactly, but when I told him how you were under the same roof as Maka Khan and the Akali, didn't he jump just? Didn't come himself, though. Bad policy for him to be seen crossing the Khalsa, don't you know? But he told off the Jemadar in a detail, and we hit the leather. I scouted the house, but no sign of you. A couple of sentries perambulating in the garden, though, and then I heard you hollering from the back of the house. I took a quiet slant that way and marked the window your noise seemed to be coming from. Say, you're a right audible soldier, ain't you? After that, two of the Jemadar's fellows smoothed out the sentries and took station while he and I slipped along to your window. And here you are. They're capable, Alec's boys, no error. But what took you into that bear's den, and what in creation were they doing to you? I didn't tell him. The events of the night were still a hideous jumble in my mind, and reaction had me in its grip. I was shaking so hard I barely kept the saddle. I wanted to vomit, and my ankle was throbbing with pain. Once again, when all seemed well, Lahore had become a nightmare, with enemies all about. The only bright side was that there seemed no lack of worthy souls eager to pluck me out of the soup. God bless America, if you like. They'd turned up trumps again at no small risk to themselves, for if the Khalsa got wind that Gardner was aiding enemies of the state, he'd be in Queer Street. "Don't you fret about Alec," snorts Jazza. "He's got more lives than a cat and more nuts on the fire than you can count. He's Dalip's man and Jeendan's man and best chums with Broadfoot. And he's Gulab Singh's agent in Lahore and..." Gulab Singh. That was another who took an uncommon interest in Flash's welfare. I was beginning to feel like a fives pill being thrashed about in a four-hand 15-up, with my seams split and the twine showing. Well, to the devil with it, I'd had enough. I reined in and demanded of Jazza where we were going. I'd been half aware that we were threading our way through the alleys near the south wall, and once or twice we'd skirted under the wall itself. We'd passed the great Luhari gate and the half-moon battery and were abreast of the Shah Alumi, which meant we were holding east, and were no nearer the fort than when we'd started. Not that I minded that. "For I'm not going back there, I can tell you. Broadfoot can peddle his pack and be damned. This bloody place ain't safe." "That's what Gardner reckoned," says Jazza. "He thinks you should make tracks for British territory. You know the war has started. Yes, sir, the Khalsa's over the river at half a dozen places between Hauri Kipatan and Ferozepur. 80,000 horse, foot and guns on a 30-mile front. God knows where Gough is. Halfway to Delhi with his tail between his legs, if you believe the bazaar. But I doubt it." 7,000 at Ferozepur, I was thinking. Well, Littler was done for. Wheeler, too, with his pitiful 5,000 at Ludhiana. Unless Gough had managed to reinforce. I'd had no sure word for 3 weeks, but it didn't seem possible that he could have concentrated strongly enough to resist the overwhelming Sikh tide that was pouring over the Sutlej. I thought of the vast horde I'd seen on Mayan Mir, the massed battalions of foot, the endless squadrons of horse, those superb guns, and of Gough, frustrated at every turn by that ass Harding. Our sepoys on the edge of desertion or mutiny, our piecemeal garrisons strung along the frontier and down the Meerut Road. Now it had come, like a hammer blow, and we'd been caught napping, as usual. Well, Gough had better have God on his side, for if he didn't... Farewell, India. Which mattered rather less to me than the fact that I was a fugitive with a game ankle in the heart of the enemy camp. So much for Broadfoot's idiot notions. I'd be safe in Lahore during hostilities, indeed. A fat lot of protection Jinda could give me now with the Khalsa wise to her treachery. It would be a talwar, not a diamond, that would be decorating her pretty navel shortly. Moochie Gate, says Jasser, and over the low hovels I saw the towers ahead and to our right. We were approaching a broad street leading down to the gate, and the mouth of the alley was crowded with bystanders, even at that time of night, all craning to see. A band of music was playing a spirited march. There was the steady tramp of feet. And down the avenue to the gate came three regiments of Khalsa infantry. Stalwart musketeers in white, with black cross-belts. Their pieces at the shoulder, bayonets fixed. Then Dogra light infantry in green, with white trousers, muskets at the trail. A battalion of spearmen in white flowing robes, their sashes bristling with pistols, their broad turbans wound round steel caps surmounted by green plumes. They swung along with a fierce purpose that made my heart sink, the flaring cressets on the wall glittering on that forest of steel as it passed under the arch, the girls showering them with petals as they passed, the chicos striding alongside, shrilling with delight. Half Lahore seemed to have left its bed that night to see the troops march away to join their comrades on the river. As each regiment approached the arch, it gave a great cheer, and I thanked God for the shadows as I saw that they were saluting a little knot of mounted officers in gorgeous coats, with the rotund figure of Tej Singh at their head. He was wearing a puggaree as big as himself, and enough jewelry to start a shop. He shook a sheathed tulwar over his head in response to the troops' weapons brandished in unison as they chanted, Khalsa ji wa guru ji ko fateh, to Delhi, to London, victory! After them came cavalry, regular units, lancers in white, and dragoons in red, jingling by. And finally a baggage train of camels, and Tej left off saluting, the band gave over, and people turned away to the booths and grog shops. Jasser told the Jemadar to have the riders follow us singly, and then my rider dismounted, and Jasser began to lead my beast down towards the gate. "Hold on," says I. "Where away?" "Well, that's your way home, wouldn't you say?" says he. And when I reminded him that I was all in, dry, famished, and one-legged, he grinned all over his ugly mug and said that would be attended to directly, I'd see. So I let him lead on under the great arch, past the spearmen standing guard in their mail coats and helms. My puggaree, like my sword and pepper-box, had gone during the evening's activities. But one of the riders had lent me a cloak with a hood, which I kept close about my face, so no one gave us a second glance. Beyond the gate were the usual shanties and hovels of the beggars, but farther out on the Maidan a few campfires were winking, and Jasser made for one beside a little grove of white poplars, where a small tent was pitched, with a couple of horses picketed close by. The first streak of dawn was lightening the sky to the east, silhouetting the camels and wagons on the southern road. The night air was dry and bitter cold, and I was shivering as we reached the fire. A man, squatting on a rug beside it, rose at our approach, and before I saw his face I recognized the long, rangy figure of Gardner. He nodded curtly to me and asked Jasser if there'd been any trouble or pursuit. "Now, Alec, you know me," cries that worthy, and Gardner growled that he did, and how many signatures had he forged along the way. "The same genial Gardner Khan, I could see, but just the sight of that fierce eye and jutting nose made me feel safe for the first time that night. "What's wrong with your foot?" snaps he as I climbed awkwardly down and leaned wincing on Jasser. I told him, and he swore, "You have a singular gift for making the sparks fly upward. Let's have a look at it." He prodded, making me yelp. "Damnation, it'll take days to mend. Very well, Dr. Harland, there's cold water in the chatty. Let's see you exercise a medical skill that was the talk of Pennsylvania. I don't doubt
There's curry in the pan and coffee on the fire.
He picketed the horse while I wolfed curry and chapatis and Jasser bound my ankle with a cold cloth. It was badly sprained and swollen like a football, but he had a soothing touch and made it feel easier. Gardner came back to squat, cross-legged, beyond the fire, drinking coffee with the aid of his iron neck clamp, and eyeing me sourly. He'd left off his bumbee tartan rig, no doubt to avoid notice, and wore a cowled black robe with his Khyber knife across his knees. A damned discouraging sight all round, with questions to match.
"Now, Mr. Flashman," growls he, "explain yourself. What folly took you among the Khalsa? And at such a time, too? Well, sir, what were you doing in that house?"
I knew I would be relying on him for my passage home, so I told him all of it, from the false message to Jasser's rescue, and he listened with a face like flint. The only interruption came from Jasser when I mentioned my encounter with Gulab Singh.
"You don't say the old golden hen? Now what would he be doing so far from Kashmir?"
Gardner rounded on him.
"Minding his own damn business, and you'll do likewise, Josiah, you hear me? Not a word about him. Yes, while I think on it, you best take yourself out of earshot."
"That's for Mr. Flashman to say," retorts Jasser.
"Mr. Flashman agrees with me,"
barks Gardner, fixing me with a cold eye, so I nodded, and Jasser loafed off in a pet.
"He did well by you tonight," says Gardner, watching him go, "but I still wouldn't trust him across the street. Go on."
I finished my tale, and he observed with grim satisfaction that it had all fallen out for the best. I said I was glad he thought so, and pointed out that it wasn't his arse that had been toasted over a slow fire. He just grunted.
"Micah Khan had never gone through with it. He tried to scare you, but torture isn't his style." "The devil it ain't. Good God, man, I was half broiled. I tell you, those swine would have stopped at nothing. Why, they roasted my punkawala to death."
"So they told you. Even if they did, a no-account nigger is one thing, a white officer's another.
Still, you were lucky. Thanks to Josiah. Yes, and to Gulab Singh."
I asked him why he thought Gulab and the widow had taken such risks on my behalf, and he stared at me as though I were half-witted.
"He told you plain enough, I'd say. The more good turns he does the British, the better they'll like him. He's promised to stand by him in the war, but protecting you is worth a thousand words. He's counting on you to do him credit with Harding. And you do it, you hear? Gulab's an old fox, but he's a brave man and a strong ruler, and deserves to have your people confirm him as king in Kashmir when this war's over."
Seemed to me he was being optimistic in thinking we'd be in a position to confirm anyone in Kashmir when the Khalsa had done with us. But I didn't care to croak in front of a Yankee, so I said offhand,
"You think we'll beat the Khalsa quite handily, then?" "There'll be some damn long faces in Lahore for it if you don't," says he bluntly, and before I could ask him to explain that bewildering remark, he added, "But you'll be able to watch the fight from the ringside yourself before the week's out."
"I don't see that," says I. "I agree I can't stay in Lahore, but I'm in no case to ride for the frontier in a hurry either, not with this confounded leg. I mean, even in disguise, you never know, I might have to cut and run, and I'd rather have two sound pins for that. What? So you'd best find me a safe, comfortable spot to lie up in meanwhile," was what I was hinting, and waited for him to agree. He didn't.
"We can't wait for your leg to mend. This war is liable to be won and lost in a few days at most, which means you must be across the Sutlej without delay, even if you have to be carried."
He glared at me, whiskers bristling.
"The fate of India may well depend on that, Mr. Flashman."
The sun couldn't have got him, not in December, and he wasn't tight. Tactfully, I asked him how the fate of India came into it, since I had no vital intelligence to take with me, and my addition to the forces of the company, while no doubt welcome in its small way, could hardly be decisive.
"Forces of the company? My aunt's petticoat!" snarls he. "You're going in with the Khalsa." If life has taught me anything at all, it's how to keep my countenance in the presence of strong, authoritative men whose rightful place is in a padded cell. I've known the power of them, to my cost, and Alec Gardner's a minor figure in a list that includes the likes of Bismarck, Palmerston, Lincoln, Gordon, John Charity Spring, M.A., George Custer, and the White Roger, to say nothing of my beloved mentor, Dr. Arnold, and my old governor, who did end his days in a blue devil factory, bless him. Many of them men of genius, no doubt, but all sharing the delusion that they could put any proposal, however lunatic, to young Flashy and make him like it. There's no arguing with such fellows, of course. All you can do, if you're lucky, is nod and say, "Well, sir, that's an interesting notion, to be sure. Just before you tell me more about it, would you excuse me for a moment?" And once you're round the corner, make for the high ground. I've seldom had that chance, unfortunately, and there's nothing for it but to sit with an expression of attentive idiocy trying to figure a way out, which is what I did with Gardner while he elaborated his monstrous suggestion. "You're going with the Kalsa," says he, "to ensure its defeat. It's doomed and damned already, thanks to my Giantan, but you can make it certain." You see what I mean? The man was plainly must. Must is the madness of the rogue elephant. Doolally equals insane from Deolally Camp, inland from Bombay, where generations of British soldiers, including the editor, were received in India and supposedly were affected by sunstroke. As I say, must, and Doolally, afflicted of Allah, too long in the hills altogether. But one doesn't like to say so straight out, not to a chap who affects tartan pants and has a Khyber knife across his lap. So I avoided the main point for a lesser but equally curious one. "I don't quite follow, Gardner, old fellow," says I. "You say the Khalsa's doomed, and it's Giandan's doing. But she never wanted this war, you know. She's been working to avoid it, hocusing the Khalsa, delaying them, holding them back. They know it, too. Maka Khan told me. And now they've broken loose in spite of her." "In spite of? Why, you jackass," cries he, glaring like the Ancient Mariner. "She started it. Don't you understand? She's been planning this war for months. Why? To destroy the Khalsa, of course. To see it exterminated, root and branch. Sure, she held them back until the cold weather, until she'd fixed it so they have the worst possible generals, until she'd bought time for guff. But not to avoid war, no, sir. Just to make sure that when she did send them in, the Khalsa would get whipped five ways to Sunday. Don't you know that?" "Talk sense. Why should she want to destroy her own army?" "Because if she doesn't, it will sure as hell destroy her in the end." He fetched a deep breath. "See here. You know the Khalsa's gotten too big for its britches, don't you? For 6 years it's been ruining the Punjab, defying government, doing as it damn well pleases. Well, I know all that, but, well, don't you see, the ruling clique, Giandan and the nobles, have had their power and fortunes wiped out, their very existence threatened. So, of course, they want the Khalsa crushed, and the only force on earth that can do that is John Company. That's why they've been trying to provoke a war. That's why Jawa here wanted one. But they murdered him, and that's another score my Giandan has to settle. You remember her that night at Mayan Muir, don't you? She was sentencing the Khalsa then, Mr. Flashman. Now she's executing them." I remembered her screaming hate at the Khalsa over Jawahir's body, but Gardner still wasn't making sense. "Damn it, if the Khalsa goes under, she'll go with it," I protested. "She's their queen, and you say she's set them on? Well, if they lose, she'll be finished, won't she?" He sighed, shaking his head. "Son, it won't even take the dander out of her hair. When they lose, she's won. Consider. Britain doesn't want to conquer the Punjab. Too much trouble. It just wants it nice and quiet, with no Khalsa running wild. And a stable Sikh government will do what Harding tells them. So, when the Khalsa's licked, your chiefs won't annex the Punjab. No, sir, they'll find it convenient to keep little Dalip on the throne, with Giandan as regent. which means that she and the nobles will be riding high again, squeezing the fat out of the country just like old times, and with no council to worry about.
Hold on, are you saying that this war's a put-up job that they know and similar that Jerndon is hoping will destroy our army for her own benefit? I won't have that. Why, it'd be collusion, conspiracy, aiding and abetting.
No such thing. Oh, they know in similar what she's after, or they suspect leastways. But what can they do about it? Give the Khalsa free passage to Delhi? He snorted. Harding's got to fight, whether he likes it or not. And while he may not welcome the war, there are plenty of forward policy men like Broadfoot who do. But that doesn't mean they're in cahoots with my Jerndon. The way she's fixed things, they don't need to be.
I sat silent, trying to take it in, and feeling no end of a fool. Evidently I'd misjudged the lady. Oh, I'd guessed there was steel inside my drunken, avid little houri, but hardly of the temper that could slaughter scores of thousands of men just for her own political convenience and personal comfort. Mind you, what other reasons do statesmen and princes ever have for making war when all the sham's been stripped away? Oh, and she had a sot of a brother to avenge, to be sure. But I wondered if her calculations were right. I could spot one almighty imponderable, and I voiced it to Gardner, whether it sounded like croaking or not.
But suppose we don't beat the Khalsa, how can she be so sure we will? There's a hell of a lot of them, and we're spread thin. Wait, though. Maka Khan was in a great sweat in case she betrayed their plans of campaign. Well, has she?
Gardner shook his head.
She's done better than that. She's put the conduct of the war in the hands of Lal Singh, her wazir and lover, and Tej Singh, her commander-in-chief who'd set fire to his own mother to keep warm.
He nodded grimly.
They'll see to it that Gaff doesn't have too much trouble.
Suddenly I remembered Lal Singh's words to me.
I wonder how we should acquit ourselves against such a seasoned campaigner as Sir Hugh Gough.
My God, says I with reverence, you mean they're ready to fight a cross? To sell the pass? But does Gough know? I mean, have they arranged with him?
No, sir, that's your part. That's why you have to join the Khalsa.
He leaned forward, the hawk face close to mine.
You're going to Lal Singh. By tomorrow he'll be lying before Ferozepur with 20,000 Gorachara. He'll tell you his plans and Tej Singh's. Numbers, armaments, dispositions, intentions, all of it. And you'll carry them to Gough and Harding. And then... Well, it should be an interesting little war. What's the matter?
I'd been struggling for speech during this fearful recital, but when I found words, it wasn't to protest or argue or scream, but to pose a profound military question.
But, hell's bells, look here, they can give away plans. Arrange for a few regiments to go astray, lose a battle on purpose, I dare say. But man alive, how do they betray an army of 100,000 men? I mean, how do you sell a whole war?
It'll take management, no denying. As I said, an interesting little war. He tossed another billet on the fire and rose.
When it's over, and you're back in Lahore with the British peace mission, you can tell me all about it.
My first thought, as I sat by the fire with my head in my hands, was, this is Broadfoot's doing. He's planned the whole hideous thing, start to finish, and kept me in the dark to the last moment. The treacherous, crooked, conniving, Scotch, political... Well, I was doing him an injustice, for once George was innocent. He might welcome the war, as Gardner had said, and have a shrewd notion that Jerndon was launching the Khalsa in the hope of seeing it wrecked. But neither he nor anyone else in Simla knew that the Sikh's two leading commanders were under her orders to give the whole game away. Nor could he guess the base use that was being made of his prize agent, Lieutenant Flashman, late 11th Hussars, in this hour of crisis. The notion that I should be the messenger of betrayal had been another inspiration of Jerndon's, according to Gardner. How long she'd had me in mind for the role of go-between, he didn't know. She'd confided it to him only the previous day, and he and Mangler would have brought me my marching orders that same night.
if I hadn't been away gallivanting with the Khalsa and Gulab and the Merry Widow. Most inconsiderate of me, but all's ill that ends ill. Here I was still, ankle crocked and guts fermenting with fright, meat to be hurled into the soup in furtherance of that degenerate royal doxy's intrigues, and no way to cry off that I could see. I tried, you may be sure, pleading my ankle, and the impossibility of taking orders from any but my own chiefs, and the folly of venturing again among enemies who'd already toasted me to a turn. Gardiner answered every objection with the blunt fact that someone had to take Lowell's plans to Gough, and no one else had my qualifications. It was my duty, says he, and if you wonder that I bowed to his authority, well, take a squint at the portrait in his memoirs. That should convince you. I'm still not sure, by the way, exactly where his loyalties lay. To Dalip and Jind, uncertainly. What she ordered, he performed. But he played a staunch game on our behalf, too, and on Gulab Singh's. When I ventured to ask him where he stood, he looked down that beak of a nose and snapped, "On my own 2 feet!" So there. He had Jindan's infernal scheme all pat, and after I'd had a couple of hours' sleep and Jasso had rebound my swollen ankle, he lined it out to me. Horrid risky, it sounded. "You ride straight hence to Lal's camp beyond the Sutlej with 4 of my men as escort, all of you disguised as Gorachara. Ganpat there will act as leader and spokesman. He's a safe man." This was his Jemadar, a lean Punjabi with an Abanaza moustache. He and the half-dozen other riders had come out from the city by now and were loafing round the fire, chewing beetle and spitting, while Gardiner bullied me privately. "You'll arrive by night, presenting yourselves as messengers from the Durbar. That'll see you into Lal's presence. He'll be expecting you. Word of mouth goes to him today from Jindan. Suppose Maka Khan or that bloody Akadi turn up. They'll recognize me straight off. They'll be nowhere near. They're infantrymen. Lal commands only cavalry and horse guns. Besides, no one's going to know you in Gorachara gear, and you won't be in their camp long enough to signify, a few hours at most, just long enough to learn what Lal and Tej mean to do." "Well, take Ferozepur," says I. "That's plain. They're bound to put Littler out of the game before Gough can relieve him." He gave an impatient snarl. "That's what they'd do if they wanted to win the goddamn war. They don't. But their brigadiers and colonels do, so Lal and Tej are going to have to look as though they're trying like hell. Lal's going to have to think of some damn good reason for not storming Ferozepur, and since he's a duffer of a soldier as well as a yellow belly, he's liable to go cross-eyed if his subordinates present him with a sound plan. Now what?"
"Well, it won't do," I bleated. "Maka Khan told me the Khalsa already suspect them of disloyalty. Well, heavens above, the moment Lal makes a move or gives an order even that looks fishy, while they'll see he's pissing on his own wicket. Well, eh? Who's to say what's a fishy move or why it's being made? You were in Afghanistan. How many times did Elphinstone do the sensible thing? Tell me that. He was always wrong, goddammit."
"Yes, but that was fat-headedness, not treachery. Who knows the difference, confound it? You did what you were told, and so will the Khalsa colonels. What do they know if they're told to march from A to B, or retire from C, or open a candy store at D? They can't see the whole canvas, only their own corner of it. Sure, they know Lal and Tej are cowardly rascals who turn tail sooner than eat, but they're still bound to obey." He gnawed his whiskers, growling. "I said it'll take managing, by Lal and Tej, and by Gough once he's learned from you what they're about." He stabbed me with a bony finger. "From you? That's the point. If Lal sent a native agent promising betrayal, Gough wouldn't give him the time of day, but he knows you and can trust what you tell him." And much good it would do him, I thought, for however Lal and Tej mismanaged the Khalsa, they couldn't alter its numbers, or the zeal of its colonels, or the quality of its soldiers, or the caliber of its guns. They might supply Gough with full intelligence, but he was still going to have to engage and break a disciplined army of 100,000 men, with a company force 1/3 the size, and undergunned. I'd not have wagered 2 pice on his chances. But then, you see, I didn't know him. For that matter, I didn't know much about war. Afghanistan had been a rout, not a campaign, and Borneo an apprenticeship in piracy. I'd never seen a pucker battle, or the way a seasoned commander, even one as daft as Paddy Goff, can manage an army, or the effect of centuries of training and discipline, or that phenomenon which I still don't understand, but which I watch too often to doubt, the British peasant looking death in the face and hitching his belt and waiting. My chief concern, of course, was the prospect of venturing into the heart of the Khalsa and conspiring with a viper like Lal Singh, with a game leg to prevent me lighting out at speed if things went amiss, as they were bound to do. Even sitting a mount hurt like sin, and to make matters worse, Gardner said Jassim must stay behind. I couldn't demur. Half the Punjab knew that crafty fizz, and that he was my orderly. But he'd pulled me clear 2 times now, and I'd feel naked without him. "Broadfoot needs a foot on the ground here, anyway," says Gardner. "Never fear, dear Josiah will be safe under my wing, and under my eye. While the war lasts, I'm to be governor of Lahore, which between ourselves is liable to consist of protecting my Jiandam when her disappointed soldiery come pouring back over the river. Yes, sir, we surely earn our wages." He surveyed me in my Gorachara outfit, of which the most important part was a steel cap like a roundhead's, with long cheek pieces that helped conceal my face. "You'll do. Let your beard grow and leave the talking to Ganpat. You'll make Kasur this afternoon, lie up there and go down to the river Ghat after dark, and you should fetch up with Lal Singh around dawn tomorrow. I'll ride along with you a little ways." We set off, the 6 of us, at about 10 o'clock, riding parallel with the south road. It was heavy with traffic for the Khalsa. Baggage and ration carts, ammunition wagons, even teams of guns, for we were riding with the rear guard of the army. A vast host spread across the dusty plain, moving slowly south and east. Ahead of us, the Doab, that's the name given to the tracts between the rivers of the Punjab, would be alive with the main body as far as the Sutlej, beyond which Lal Singh was already investing for Rozapur, and Tej Singh's infantry would be advancing whither. We rode at a fast trot, which troubled my ankle, but Gardner insisted we must keep up the pace if I was to reach Lal in time. "He's been over the Sutlej 2 days now. Goff must be moving, and Lal's going to have to take order pretty sharp, or his colonels will want to know why. I only hope," says Gardner grimly, "that the weak-kneed son of a bitch doesn't run away, in which case we might just have the Gorachara under the command of someone who knows what the hell he's doing." The more I thought of it, the madder the whole thing sounded, but the maddest part of it was still to be revealed. We'd made our noon halt, and Gardner was turning back to Lahore, but first he rode a little way apart with me to make sure I had it all straight. We were on a little knoll about a furlong from the road, along which a battalion of Sikh infantry was marching, tall stalwarts all in olive green, with their colonel riding ahead, colours flying, drums beating, bugles sounding a rousing air. Gardner may have said something to prompt my question, but I don't recall. At any rate, I asked him, "See here, I know the Khalsa's been spoiling for this, but if they know their own Maharani's been conspiring with the enemy and suspect their own commanders, well, even the rank and file must have a shrewd idea their rulers want to see them beat. So why are they allowing themselves to be sent to war at all?" He pondered this and gave one of his rare wintry smiles. "They reckon they can whip John Company. Whoever may be crossing or betraying them don't matter. They think they can be champions of England, in which case they'll be the masters of Hindustan, with an empire to plunder. Maybe my Jiandan has that possibility in mind, too, and figures she'll win either way. Oh, she could charm away the suspicions of treason. Most of them still worship her. Another reason they have for marching is that they believe you British will invade them sooner or later, so they might as well strike first. He paused for a moment, frowning, and then said, "But that's not the half of it. They're going to war because they've taken their oaths to Dalip Singh Maharaja, and he's sent them out in his name. Never mind who put the words in his mouth. So even if they knew they were doomed beyond a doubt, they'd go to the sacrifice." He turned to look at me. "You don't know the Sikhs, sir. I do. They'll fight their way to hell and back. For that little boy. And for their salt." He sat gazing across the plain, where the marching battalion was disappearing into the heat haze, the sun twinkling on the bayonets, the sound of the bugles dying away. He shaded his eyes, and it was as though he was talking to himself. "And when the Khalsa's beat, and Jind and her noble crew are firm in the saddle again, and the Punjab's quiet under Britannia's benevolent eye, and little Dalip's getting his hide turned at Eton College, why then—" he gestured towards the road. "Then, sir, John Company will find he has 100,000 of the best recruits on earth ready to fight for the White Queen. Because that's their trade. And it'll all have turned out best for everybody, I guess. A lot of good men will have died first, though. Sikh, Indian, British." He glanced at me and nodded. "That's why Harding has held off all this time. He's probably the only man in India who thinks the price is too high. Now it's going to be paid." He was a strange bird, this, all bark and fury most of the time, then quiet and philosophical, which sorted most oddly with his gauzy figurehead. He chucked the reins and wheeled his pony. "Good luck, soldier. Give my salams to old Georgie Broadfoot." I've never cared much for service with foreign forces. At best it's unfamiliar and uncomfortable, and the rations allow to play havoc with your innards. The American Confederates weren't bad, I suppose, bar their habit of spitting on carpets. And the worst I can say of the Yankees is that they took soldiering seriously and seemed to be under the impression that they'd invented it. But the Malagasy army, of which I was sergeant general, was simply disgusting. The Apaches stink and know damn all about camp discipline. No one in the Foreign Legion speaks decent French. The boots don't fit and the bayonet scabbard is a clanking piece of scrap. All round, the only aliens in whose military employ I could ever be called happy with were the sky-blue wolves of Kokand. That was only because I was full of hashish administered by their general's mistress after I'd rogered her in his absence. As for the Khalsa, the one good thing about my service in its ranks, or perhaps I should say on its general staff, was that it was short and to the point. I counted from the moment we set out south, the six of us in column of twos, Gorachara to the life in our oddments of mail and plate and eccentric weapons. Gardner had furnished me with two pistols and a saber, and while I'd have swapped the lot for my old pepper box, I consoled myself that with luck I'd never need to use them. I was in two minds as we cantered down towards Luliani. On the one hand, I was relieved to elation at leaving the horrors of Lahore behind me. When I thought of that hellish gridiron and Chandkur's bath and the ghastly fate of Jawahir, even the knowledge that I was venturing into the heart of the Khalsa didn't seem so fearful. A glance at the scowling, unshaven thug reflected in Gardner's pocket mirror told me that I needn't fear detection. I might have come straight from Peshawar Valley and no questions asked. And Lal Singh, being up to his arse in treason, would be sure to speed me on my way in quick time. In 2 days at most I'd be with my own people again. With fresh laurels, too, as the man who brought the news that saved the army. If it did save it, that is. That was t'other side of the coin, and as we rode into the thick of the invading army, all my old fears came flooding back. We kept clear of the road, which was choked with transport trains, but even on the Doab we found ourselves riding through regiment after regiment, marching in open order across the great sun-baked plain. Twice, as you know, I'd seen the Khalsa mustered, but it seemed that the half hadn't been shown unto me. Now they covered the land to the horizon. Men, wagons, horses, camels, and elephants, churning up the red dust into a great haze that hung overhead in the windless air, making noontide like dusk, and filling the eyes and nostrils and lungs. When we came to Kasaur, late in the afternoon, it was one great park of artillery, line upon line of massive guns, 32 and 48 pounders, and I thought of our pathetic 12 and 16 pounders and horse artillery, and wondered how much use Lal's betrayal would be. Well, whatever befell, I'd just have to play my game leg for all it was worth and keep well clear of the action. There's a great debate, by the way, about how large the Khalsa was and how long it took to cross the Sutlej, but the fact is that even the Sikhs don't know. I reckoned about 100,000 were on the move from Lahore to the river, and I know now that they'd been crossing in strength for days and already had 50,000 on the south bank, while Gough and Harding were trying to scramble their dispersed 30,000 together. But muster rolls don't win wars. Concentration does. Not only getting their fustest with the mostest, as the chap said, but bringing them to bear in the right place. That's the secret. And if you run into Lars Porsena, he'll be the first to tell you. At the time, I only knew what I could see. Camp fires all about us in a vast twinkling sea as we came down by night to the Ferozepur Ghat. Even in the small hours, they were swarming over the ferry in an endless tide. Great burning bales had been set on high poles on either bank, glaring red on the 300 yards of oily water, and men and guns and beasts and wagons were being pulled across on anything that could float. Barges and rafts, and even rowing boats. There were whole regiments waiting in the dark to take their turn, and the Ghat itself was bedlam. But Ganpat thrust ahead, bawling that we were Durbar couriers, and we were given passage in a fisher craft carrying a general and his staff. They ignored us poor Gorachara, and presently we came to the noisy confusion of the southern bank and made our way by inquiry to the wazir's headquarters. Ferozepur itself lay a couple of miles or so from the river, with the Sikhs in between, and how far their camp extended up the south bank, God alone knows. They'd been crossing as far up as Hari Keh, and I suppose they'd made a bridgehead of about 30 miles, but I ain't certain. As near as I've been able to figure, Lal's headquarters lay about 2 miles due north of Ferozepur, but it was still dark when we passed through the lines of tent lanes, all ablaze with torches. Most of his force were Gorachara like ourselves, and my memory is of fierce bearded faces in steel caps, beasts stamping in the dark, and the steady throb of drums that they kept up all night, doubtless to encourage Littler and his beleaguered outpost 2 miles away. Lal's quarters were in a pavilion big enough to hold Astley's circus. It even had smaller tents within it to house him and his retinue of staff and servants and personal bodyguard. These last were tall villains with long chain-mail headdresses and ribbons on their muskets. They barred our way until Ganpat announced our business, which caused a great scurry and consultation with chamberlains and butlers. Although it was still the last watch and the great man was asleep, it was decided to wake him at once, so he didn't have to wait above an hour before being ushered into his sleeping pavilion, a silken sanctum decked out like a bordello, with Lal sitting up naked in bed, while one wench dressed his hair and combed his beard, another sprayed him with perfume, and a third plied him with drink and titbits. I've never seen a man in such a funk in my life. At our previous meetings he'd been as cool, urbane, and commanding as a handsome young Sikh noble can be. Now he was like a virgin with the vapors. He gave me one terrified glance and looked quickly away, his fingers tugging nervously at the bedclothes while the wenches completed his toilet. And when one of them dropped her comb, he squealed like a spoiled child, slapped her, and drove them out with shrill curses. Ganpat followed them, and the moment he'd gone, Lal was tumbling out of bed, hauling his robe about him and yammering at me in a hoarse whisper.
"Praise God you are here at last. I thought you would never come. What is to be done?"
He was fairly quivering with fright.
"I've been at my wits' end for 2 days, and Tej Singh is no help, the swine. He sits at Arufka pretending he must supervise the assembly, and leaves me here alone. Everyone is looking to me for orders. What in God's name am I to say to them?"
"What have you said already?"
"Why, that we must wait. What else can I say, man? But we can't wait forever. They keep telling me that Ferozepore can be plucked like a ripe fruit, if I will but give the word. And how can I answer them? How can I justify delay? I don't know."
He seized me by the wrist, pleading.
"You are a soldier. You can think of reasons. What shall I tell them?"
I hadn't reckoned on this. I'd always thought myself God's own original coward, but this fellow could have given me 10 yards in 100, and one screaming. Well, Gardner had warned me of that, and also that Lal might have difficulty thinking of reasons for not attacking Ferozepore, but I hadn't expected to find him at such a complete nonplus as this. The man was on the edge of hysterics, and plainly the first thing to be done was to calm his panic, before it infected me, for one thing, and find out how the land lay. I began by pointing out that I was an invalid. I'd only been able to limp into his presence with the aid of a stick, and that my first need was food, drink, and a doctor to look at my ankle. That took him aback. It always does, when you remind an Oriental of his manners. And his women were summoned to bring refreshments, while a little Hakim clucked over my swollen joint and said I must keep my bed for a week. What they thought, to see a hairy Gorachara Sawa treated with such consideration by their wazir, I don't know. Lal fretted up and down and couldn't wait to drive them out again and renew his appeals for guidance. By that time I'd got my thoughts into some order, at least as far as his Ferozepore dilemma was concerned. There are always 100 good reasons for doing nothing, and I'd hit on a couple. But first I must have information. I asked him how many men he had ready to march.
"At hand, 22,000 cavalry. They're lying a bare mile from Ferozepore, with enemy lines in full view, I tell you. And little Sahib has a bare 7,000, only one British regiment, and the rest sepoys ready to desert to us. We know this from some who have already come over."
He gulped at his cup, his teeth chattering on the rim.
"We could overrun him in an hour. Even a child can see that.
Have you sent messengers to him?"
"As if I would dare. Who could I trust? Already these Khalsa bastards look at me askance. Let them suspect that I traffic with the enemy and..."
He rolled his eyes and flung his cup away in a passion.
"And that drunken bitch in Lahore gives me no help, no orders. While she couples with her grooms, I wait to be butchered like Jawahir.
Now see here, wazir," says I roughly, for his whining was starting to give me the shakes. "You take hold, do you hear? Your position ain't all that desperate."
"You see a way out,"
quavers he, clutching at me again.
"Oh, my dear friend, I knew you would not fail me. Tell me then, and let me embrace you.
You keep your bloody distance," says I. "What's Littler doing?"
"Fortifying his lines. Yesterday he came out with his whole garrison, and we thought he meant to attack us and held our ground. But my colonel said it was a feint to gain time, and that I must storm his trenches. Oh, God, what can I—"
"Hold on. He's entrenched, you say? Is he still digging? Capital. You can tell your colonels he's mining his defences.
But will they believe me?"
He wrung his hands.
"Suppose the deserters deny it?"
"Why should you trust deserting sepoys? How do you know Littler hasn't sent him to give you false reports of his strength, eh? To lure you into attacking him. Ferozepore's a ripe fruit, is it? Come, Raja, you know the British, foxy bastards, every one of us. Deuced odd, ain't it, that we've left a weak garrison cut off just asking to be attacked, what?" He stared wide-eyed.
"Is this true?"
"I doubt it. But you don't know that," says I, warming to my work. "Anyway, it's a damn good reason to give your colonels for not attacking headlong. Now then, what force has Tej Singh and where?"
30,000 infantry with heavy guns behind us along the river.
He shuddered.
Thank God I have only light artillery. With heavy pieces I should have no excuse for not blowing Littler's position to rubble.
Never mind Littler. What news of Gough?
2 days ago he was at Lutwala, 100 miles away. He will be here in 2 days, but word is that he has scarcely 10,000 men, only half of them British. If he comes on, we are sure to defeat him.
He was almost crying, wrenching off his beard net and trembling like a fever case.
What can I do to prevent it, even if I give reasons for not taking Ferozepur? I cannot avoid battle with a janky lot. Help me, Flashman Bahadur, tell me what I must do.
Well, this was a real facer, if you like. Gardner, for all his misgivings about Lal, had been sure that he and Tej would have some scheme for leading their army to destruction. That was what I was here for, damn it, to carry their plans to Gough. And it was plain as a pikestaff that they hadn't any. And Lal expected me, a junior officer, to plot his own defeat for him. And as I stared at that shivering, helpless clown, it came to me with awful clarity that if I didn't, no one else would. It ain't the kind of problem you meet every day. I doubt if it's ever been posed at Staff College. Now then, Mr. Flashman, you command an army 50,000 strong, with heavy guns, well supplied, their lines of communication protected by an excellent river. Against you is a force of only 10,000, with light guns, exhausted after a week's forced marching, short of food and fodder, and damn near dying of thirst. Now then, sir, answer directly, no hedging. How do you lose, hey? Come, come, you've just given excellent reasons for not taking a town that's lying at your mercy. This should be child's play to a man with your God-given gift of catastrophe. Well, sir... Lal was gibbering at me, his eyes full of terrified entreaty, and I knew that if I wavered now it would be all up with him. He'd break, and his colonels would either hang or depose him, and put a decent soldier in his place, the very thing that Gardner had feared. And that would be the end of Gough's advancing force, and perhaps the war, and British India, and no doubt of me. But if I could rally this spineless wreck and think of some plan that would satisfy his colonels and at the same time bring the Khalsa to destruction, aye, just so. To gain time, I asked for a map, and he pored among his gear and produced a splendid illuminated document with all the forts in red and the rivers in turquoise and little bearded wallahs with tulwars chasing each other round the margin on elephants. I studied it, trying to think, and gripping my belt to keep my hand from trembling. I've told you I didn't know much about war in those days. Tactically, I was a novice who could bungle a section flanking movement with the worst of them. But strategy's another matter. At its simplest, it's mere common sense, and if the first Sikh war was anything, it was simple, thank God. Also, strategy seldom involves your own neck. So I conned the map, weighing the facts that Lal had given me, and applied the age-old laws that you learn in the school playground. To win, the Khalsa need only take Ferozepur and wait for Gough to come and be slaughtered by overwhelming odds and big guns. To lose, they must be divided, and the weaker part sent to meet Gough with as little artillery as possible. If I could contrive that the first battle was on near-level terms, or even odds of 3-2 against us, I'd have given Gough victory on a lordly dish. Daft he might be, but he could still outmanoeuvre any Sikh commander. And if they didn't have their big guns along, British cavalry and infantry would do the business. Gough believed in the bayonet. Give him a chance to use it, and the Khalsa were beat, in the first battle at least. After that, Paddy would have to take care of the war himself. So I figured, with the sweat cold on my skin, my ankle giving me hell's delight, and Lal mumping at my elbow. Do you know, that steadied me, encountering a liver whiter than my own. Well, it don't happen that often. This is what I told him. Call your staff together, generals and brigadiers, no colonels. Tej Singh as well. Tell him you won't attack Ferozepur because it's mine. You don't trust the deserter's tale of Littler's weakness. And as wazir, it's beneath your dignity to engage anyone but the Jangi Lat himself. Also, there's a risk that if you get embroiled with Littler and Goff arrives early, you may be caught between two fires. Don't let him argue. Simply say that Ferozepur doesn't matter. Do you see? It can be wiped out when you've settled, Goff. Lay down the law, high-handed. Very good? He nodded, rubbing his face and biting his knuckle. He had the wind up to such a tune that I swear if I'd told him to march on Ceylon, he'd have cried amen. Now, your Gorachara deployed already. Send them against Goff with their horse artillery, pointing out that they outnumber him 2-1. You'll meet him somewhere between here and Woodney, and if you detach some of your force to entrench at Feroza Shah or Sultan Khan Walla, you'll reduce the odds, you see. Goff will do the rest.
But Tej Singh, he bleated, he has 30,000 infantry and the heavy guns.
He's to sit down here and watch Littler in place of your Gorachara. Yes, yes, I know that don't take 30,000 men. He must have